This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/twim.
This week on the show, Apple fanboys and Kindle fangirls square off on tablets and e-readers. The TV answers your phone, and we all need new glasses to watch it. All this on This Week in Media, number 166.
We are back, boys and girls, children of all ages, new media superstars who are listening to this show. You are listening to This Week in Media. I'm your host, Daisy Whitney. And we are not doing this show on the Twit Network today because they are recovering from CES. We will be back there next week. So if you're listening to this, you're listening to it during the week, and you're probably listening to it on your iPod or your Zune or on your computer. So thank you for doing that. And I have my usual crew and a guest today. So Alex, hello. Good to
have
you.
Hey, I'm recovering too.
Yeah, we're all recovering from CES. Tim and I actually, can you believe this? Tim and I ran into each other. I was there for literally 8 hours. And of course, with 110,000 people, I ran into Tim. So Tim, it was great to see you on Friday and good to chat with you today.
I'm still dealing with the car rental, you know, since our cars collided and, you know, getting the repairs done.
Oh, no. Wait.
From running into you.
Thanks, Daisy. No, I was walking down the hall.
I know you drove to Vegas, so I thought you were serious for a minute.
Yeah, I was walking down the hall with my buddy Ted, and I look on the floor, and there's Daisy working away on her laptop.
Tim got to see me with my Mac in action. And I actually had a camera and did some shooting myself, so I can geek out with you guys in a few minutes. But I want to introduce our guests. We have Morgan Brown from Turn Here.
Howdy, howdy, everyone.
Thank you so much for being on. And Morgan is, tell us briefly what Turn Here is, and then he's just going to kind of join in on the CES discussion.
Sure, definitely. I wasn't at CES, but I was following along with all the Twitter feeds and RSS feeds, so I feel like I was there without walking and getting covered in cigarette smoke. So, Turn Here is a internet video production and advertising company. We basically put together a big network of freelance filmmakers all around the world. We have about 8,000 of them in the network. And basically what we do is we go out and we source online video work for the videographers and filmmakers in our network. And we work both with big brands, so making video for companies like Audi for their Facebook page, or Williams-Sonoma for Williams-Sonoma.com, and a bunch of other big clients like that. And then we also make online video for small businesses for their online listings on websites like YellowPages.com, CitySearch.com, and then also just rolled out a brand new program where we're making a video, giving them a free trial. So we'll actually come out and shoot a video for a small business for free. They can try it for 3 months on their website or Facebook page and then make a decision if it's right for them for their online marketing. So that's what we do.
So you obviously have a vested interest with Turn Here in knowing kind of what the latest and greatest is and what gadgets are out there, as well as just kind of cool new trends that are coming down the pike, hence the CES tie-in.
Absolutely. And we, you know, just looking at some of the rigs that people had with their ZI-8s out there and some of the photos from using their iPhones as cameras and stuff like that's really interesting to us.
Well, we'll talk about CES in just a moment. But before we get started, we are fortunate that we have a sponsor. And Alex, I think, would be a good one to tell us about our sponsor today. So go ahead, Alex.
So we want to thank, of course, Audible.com. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. It's a leading provider in spoken word entertainment. Audible, of course, has over 50,000 titles to choose from, and you can download and play it back anywhere. Now, the one that I'm listening to right now is it's called Shop Class as Soul Craft, and it is by Matthew Crawford, and it's an inquiry into the value of work. And it's really, I find it fascinating as someone, you know, when I worked at Lucasfilm or at ILM, I mean, the big thing was we'd always talk to people who actually worked with the film. This is back when there was film for that kind of stuff. And they're the ones actually printing the film. We're like, oh, you get to touch something, you know. And I think a lot of times we get disconnected from that in the digital realm where we're not really touching anything physical anymore. And so this is really talking about working with, you know, the idea of the trades and the value of that artisan kind of approach to things. And I found it to be fascinating. So anyway, Shop Class as Soulcraft, I would highly suggest it. If you don't like that, of course, you don't need to go download that. You can download anything you want. There's 50,000 titles. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/twim, you can get a free audiobook. So if you haven't done it before, you can go up there. You can get a free audiobook. You can sample the one that I just suggested or anything else you want. And just download it and see if you like it. This is the way I read books. I'm not a unitasker when it comes to absorbing information. So if I'm sitting reading a book, I just feel like I'm wasting time. I'd rather be cleaning my house or doing something else while I'm doing it. So this is a key for me. So once again, audiblepodcast.com/TWIM. Check it out.
You know, Alex, I'm going to have to pass on that tip to my husband. He's an avid audiobook person. I'm going to let him know that you clean your house while you're listening to audiobooks and suggest that perhaps he'd like to do that as well.
Well, so my wife would love me to clean the other house as well. I have a house that's my office that's behind the main house. So when I say I clean my house, I really mean I clean my house. You know,
the one you share with your family.
All of my stuff and everything else is in my
good
house.
Save for the rest of us. Thanks, yeah. Man. You're awesome.
Yeah. Exactly. I couldn't clean that house because I'm listening to stuff, and most of the time I'm on phone calls. I'm on 3 hours of phone calls every morning, and so to manage the companies, and so I from like 6 a.m. until 9 a.m. every day, I'm on phone calls, and I just wander about cleaning surfaces because I can't do anything that requires thinking. So it keeps my house pretty clean, and I never worry about cleaning anything. I just leave things out, going, oh, I'll handle that tomorrow morning when I'm on a call.
Well, you know what makes me crazy now? When you can't actually mute a phone call that you're on, but it's not a call where you have to be taking notes on your computer or sitting down or whatever. See, I do the same thing. I work from home. And then there are certain people who just can't stand the sound of dishes being put away. And I just want to say to them, I'm just trying to get everything done. I'm the chief cook, bottle washer, writer, producer. And I just, you know, I got a house full of people. This is my time to empty the dishwasher. Sorry. Yeah. But anyway. So let's talk about the tablet. And of course, we're not just talking about the unicorn, which is not even the unicorn anymore. It's now the iSlate. And we'll probably know more about it in 2 weeks. January 26th or 27th, I think, is the official expected announcement from Apple.
Did you get an invite?
Did you? No,
no,
I didn't.
No.
Isn't that terrible? I'm ashamed and embarrassed. But now that you haven't got one either, I don't feel as bad.
I don't think Leo's got one yet.
Okay, then I won't feel that guilty because I'll know, as long as Leo hasn't gotten one, I won't take it personally.
Yeah.
Or anyway at all. But, you know, CES was really all about a lot of different tablets. I mean, Ballmer introduced one from Microsoft. You know, just a lot of companies, Toshiba, HP, so on, are talking about tablets. And, you know, in some cases, tablets that were demoed there. And now, to be honest, and just be upfront with our listeners, I didn't actually spend a lot of time on the show floor. I was only in for the day, so I don't want to make it seem as if I was going around checking out every single one. You know, but I was there. So, you know, got a sense of the energy of the show. Talked to a lot of people there. Did a lot of interviews, but didn't put my hands on every single tablet that was displayed. Nevertheless, there were a lot that were talked about, and it's interesting because you've got tablets that are, as I understand, that are kind of like of the netbook variety. That, you know, right. You kind of have a screen that can pivot around. You can hide the keyboard. You can bring it back out and use it like a Motorola click phone, like the Android phone that I use. There are some that are just sort of the pure touch screen. So there's a continuum of tablet type of devices that are closer to computing devices and that are closer to entertainment devices. Alex, Morgan, Tim, did you guys get to play around with any? Did you get to touch any? Morgan, I know you're kind of in my position, sort of, you know, checking out via a lot of articles. But for those of you who are actually on the floor, did you get to touch anything?
You know, Tim, did you touch any of them?
No, I stayed far away from them because I was hanging out with some people from that other company that has something coming out, maybe, that we're not allowed to talk about it. I forgot.
Yeah, we're allowed. The gloves are off.
We're not under NDA.
Yeah. Yeah. We're allowed to discuss
it. Yeah,
Yeah, so I didn't – I'm afraid – here's the thing is I didn't play with that much with the tablets, and the reason is because I just feel like they're all going to get wiped out. You know, like I was just like, I saw a couple of them. I saw some of the video coverage of them. I saw some of them walking by, and I just didn't, I was like, you know, the problem with most of these tablets, and so I need to say ahead of time that, you know, I'm on another show called Mac Break, mm-hmm. and I'm known to be a little bit of a Mac, you know, zealot
fanboy.
At times, fanboy. But I just have to say that as a Mac user, so almost every machine I have is dual boot. So I boot into Windows, and I have some machines that are only in Windows. So you have Windows 7 running on a bunch of my machines. I have one of my laptops at the house always has the Windows 7 on it because I'm always doing my Zune / Photosynth / other things on it. And the thing is that it's gotten better, but I believe that Windows users have a lower expectation of what the interface should do and how it should work than Mac users do. And so the issue that I think is a problem for a lot of these tablets that are coming out is they're designed by people who have a lower expectation of what the interface should do and how responsive it should be and how it should work. And I think that shows up every time you pick up something that's not an iPhone, you know, and the Droid might be better. The Nexus might be better than that. But I think that is something that inflicts a lot, you know, damage on a lot of these tablets is that the interface just isn't fluid. The other thing and I didn't play enough with these to know, but that's my, you know, I'm afraid that I'm so like, I just, and I had to rush around and cover lots and lots of stuff the one day I was there. So I just didn't,
that's
it wasn't
the
a priority.
Tough thing about CES is when you're covering it, like we're all doing, you know, actually getting, you know, it's that time on the show floor is so precious and rare.
Right.
You might wind up spending an hour one day, if at all.
Well, and I had, you know, we had 8 hours on it. We used up 8 hours on it, but I was, you know, I had to cover stuff for MacBreak and cover stuff for This Week in Photography. So those are the only two things that I was interested in is photography and Mac. And so, but the other side of this is that I just think that another hard part for all these tablet manufacturers is that competing with the iTunes store is going to be very, very, very painful. You know, the thing is that, you know, that's, Apple's going to have 10,000 applications for this iSlate in 2 months. They're going to have 100,000 inside of 12 months.
Yeah,
you know, how
absolutely.
Do you compete with that?
Yeah. I mean, I've been telling my consulting clients the same thing. It's like, let's just wait till it comes out, and then we can figure out how to make content for it, because that's
right.
The only thing that's going to matter. And then if you want to port your stuff over to whatever other stores there might be, worry about that when that happens. But this is the thing to pay attention to.
Yeah.
And I also think, you know, to add on to what Alex said is that, you know, a big part of these tablets is the data entry, right? Even if you're just surfing the web, you're writing emails, you're communicating with people, you're using Twitter, Facebook, like it's a lot of tactile kind of data entry. And so I think, you know, personally, I really only trust Apple with that. You know, there's some talk about, you know, some complex gestures that they're coming out with and all sorts of different ways to handle that. And they really nailed it with the iPhone, I think, in comparison with some of the other touchscreens. And so that whole facet of it is really, like everyone has said, you kind of have to wait and see what they're going to come out with before you jump off the tablet cliff.
Well, and I think that for me, the one thing that I generally know going into these things is that Steve is more picky than I am, which is hard.
Right.
You know, but Steve, you know, I'm very picky about stuff, and Steve is more picky, you know, and he's got good taste. I mean, I think, and I, you know, I don't know what happens to Apple when Steve's not there, you know, I mean, you know, is, you know, down the road for long periods of time. But I will say that, you know, a lot of times we are on his coattails, so to speak, that he really, you know, this device has been rumored to be floating around at Apple since 2003, 2004. You know, and the timing was viewed as not right, or this something wasn't perfect, or something wasn't ready, or Steve wasn't ready, and you know, and all of this stuff takes, you know, has taken a long time. Apple is in no rush to put something out before it's ready to go, and I feel like a lot of these other folks have rushed out because they know that there's no chance after the tablet comes out. If they don't try to take some of the space now, then they're not going to have any space to take. But I think that it's a real uphill battle for them too. Now, they might be able to compete on cost. If Apple charges $799, that's the rumor, I guess. But the rumors range anywhere from $499 to $799 is right now the kind of the range of what Apple. I tend to think it's going to be higher. There's a space for people to make a $399 or $499 or $599. You know, slate. I will say that after doing, I tried to design one of these a year and a half ago or 2 years ago. I actually built a 3D model of one that we were talking to a Korean company about 2 years ago, almost today. And the issue is I couldn't find a way to get the parts at the quality that Apple's talking about. I couldn't figure out how to get the parts below about $200. you know, that's the parts. That's not, you know, getting it all together. That's all, you know, and I understand that we're individuals, but the problem is that that's what everyone's going to be facing, is to get a high quality screen. It costs you a lot of money. To make it a touch screen, it costs you more money. To make it all small, it costs you more money. And to make it all, you know, all those things start to cost money. And that's the problem that we saw with TechCrunch's pad, is that it's very hard to make it work at $299 or $399. You know, that's what they're going to, but that's the space, is doing a less expensive one that isn't as good.
Okay, so question for you. I hear from the three of you that you're underwhelmed by what others are offering. You know, HP, Lenovo, Sony, those are all among the folks that are, you know, aiming to kind of be a challenger in this area, as this article in PC World says. Let's look at it in another way, if possible. And I'm not trying to convince you of anything. Might these other type of tablets be more competitive to netbooks, i.e., let's assume Apple is coming out with the iSlate and that it is awesome, and you know that it is, you know, sort of a larger, better, faster iPhone, does all of the great things that, you know, that the iPhone does that people know and love. But what if the, you know, these other tablets aren't necessarily aiming to be a bigger iPhone, a step up iPhone? What if they're more replacements for netbooks? Is there a market when you look at it in that way? Not necessarily for you, Alex, but is there a market? Because I don't even see you as somebody who would ever be using a netbook. But do you think they have potential in that regard?
I actually, as someone who I'm looking at moving, for instance, to a 13-inch, you know, MacBook Pro, away from my 15-inch.
You think it's like a netbook?
No. Well, I mean, but I'm saying I'm moving down in size. And yeah. I find that more and more and more, I will leave the house. I mean, you got to get up for years, a decade. It was unusual. Like, I almost felt like off kilter if I left without my laptop. Like, I just, you know, just leaving my house without my laptop, or leaving what, it just didn't happen very often. And I find that more and more I'm leaving with my iPhone, knowing that I can deal with that. You know, I can do most of what I need to do with my iPhone now that I used to do with my laptop, when I'm just doing short, you know, short trips where I don't need much oxygen. But the thing is a larger tablet, whether it's Apple or somebody else, I could definitely see myself being able to respond to emails. I mean, as most of anyone who's gotten emails from me knows, I don't type very much in my emails. And so it's so being able to do that on a touchscreen, being able to do a lot of the stuff I do on my laptop, I could totally see myself doing that.
There are people that hate Apple and will only buy a PC product. So, yeah, there's definitely a market.
Yeah, there is the anti-Apple market, which is big enough that a lot of people can make a lot of money. I think that the challenge will be, though, for all of these kind of also-rans, if they're not careful. I mean, I think that, like, for instance, on the phone side, you're looking at, you know, it looks like it's going to come down, in my opinion, it's going to come down between Apple and Google. You know, the two of them are going to race, you know, and it's going to be very hard for anyone else to kind of edge into that smartphone market. With this, I think that the high watermark is going to be, you know, it's not so much whether the device itself, I think, especially in our discussion of media, I really believe that this iSlate or whatever is going to fundamentally change the way we get content.
Let's talk about newspapers, magazines, and that sort of content on tablet type of devices. I mean, we've been looking to a large extent to what it might enable in terms of video, because, you know, we're all operating in the video world. What might this mean for newspapers? I mean, there are articles that say, I don't know that we want to even begin to call it the salvation of the newspaper business. I think we're sort of beyond that. But there's a great YouTube video that shows how Sports Illustrated content, SI.com, would look on a tablet. It's really compelling. I have the Kindle and I have the New York Times on it, and I've read a few blogs on it from time to time, and it's fine. That's, you know, whatever. But it's not really why I have the Kindle. Sorry, that's I sometimes just like to bark in the middle of conversations. That's Violet. She's saying hi. We're doing this for I'm doing this for my house. So now I've totally lost my train of thought. Oh, newspapers. So what potential does this hold for other forms of media?
Big potential. Big. I mean,
crazy.
Yeah. You look at how engaging it is. It's way more engaging than a newspaper or a magazine. And to be able to experience brands, you know, I go back and I look at how Sports Illustrated missed the boat on cable television. They let ESPN come in and steal their brand from them. This is their opportunity to get that back. And it's huge.
Well, And I think that the issue is that if all you did was put a magazine on the slate, it wouldn't be – I mean, it would be fine. And there's a lot of people that would subscribe to that. Or you could do kind of what The Economist does where you get the audio version with your subscription and access to web stuff and everything else. So you could do that. But the real revolution is going to happen when they start extending it, when they start adding video to the articles, when they start adding animations to the articles, when they start adding audio to the articles, when they start doing all of those things. It's going to get to a point where when you go and pick up the magazine, it feels like you're only getting half of what they worked on. And because the reality is they're acquiring all this content, and most of the time they can't do anything with it. You know, because it goes. You know, you can. Sure, you're doing your coverage of the Nairobi incident or whatever, but and you're for The Economist, but you're only it's all going to come out in text in one small image rather than video and interviews and all this other stuff that you can add, you know, add value. And more importantly, they can sell subscriptions and sell items via the iTunes Music Store that's ubiquitous into this thing. And that's going to change, the monetization opportunities that they have.
Yeah, this is the opportunity to put the genie back in the bottle. Yeah. And the video that Daisy talked about, if you haven't seen it, you need to watch it. Go to YouTube and Google Sports Illustrated or go to my blog, onetimstreet.com, and check it out there. It's amazing.
Yeah, I agree with
that. Yeah, Morgan, what do you think? Do you think that the magazine and newspaper industry, are they ready to fully participate in all of the opportunities that tablet devices are going to offer them?
I don't know if they're ready. I think they'll get ready, though, in a hurry. Because when you know, as Alex said, there's a ton of different monetization opportunities there. You know, if you look at some of the premium subscription models that are out there, if you're able to match up some really compelling content, you know, it feels like the magazine is only half of what is really out there for you. And, you know, when you're dealing with print, you're dealing with column widths and advertising. You know, when you're dealing in the digital space, you can pack in as much content as makes sense. So, you know, videos, podcasts, behind the scenes, interviews, all sorts of in-depth information that will really make it a much more immersive and engaging experience for the user. And then presents a lot more advertising opportunities, presents different monetization opportunities. So, yeah, I think it's going to be very compelling.
It also allows you to have different levels of content. For instance, you can have one article, and if someone wants to dig in deeper, they can choose to do that. The problem with a magazine is that you get, you know, if they did that for all the articles, you'd end up with a magazine that's four times thicker. Now you have to figure out how to get four times as many advertisers. You have to figure out how to ship that. You have to figure out all those other pieces. With this, you simply can just add those extras onto it and either let people pay more for, you know, unlock that or have more, as Morgan said, more monetization opportunities. There's a lot of other ways to kind of skin that cat, so to speak, you know, with the figuring out how to make money with that process. And I think that it's going to be really exciting. And as I said, I think part of it is also really this idea that it's easy to download, it's easy to buy. The problem with all of these ones, I mean, the Kindle is a bit of an exception, but I don't see. The problem is that once people start watching, reading books in full color with video and all this other stuff and all the other things that they could have, how do you go back to the Kindle? And Daisy, that's probably a good question for you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a conversation this morning for an article that I'm doing that'll come out later this week, so I'll mention it next week. But really sort of looking at what opportunities there are for entertainment companies, TV studios, film studios in an iSlate and tablet world. And I was talking to an executive at a TV studio, and like me, he's a Kindle user, and he said, I'm a huge fan of the content on the Kindle and the capabilities. I'm an unfan of the execution. You see, I think it's clunky. I think it's, you know, it's hard to use. It's hard to navigate. The screen's not attractive. And it's interesting because I'm definitely a Kindle fangirl for sure. I love it. You know, it's my preferred reading mechanism. But the way he said it was kind of eloquent. I thought, well, what I actually really like most about it is the ease of use. It's the size, it's the portability, it's the fact that, you know, because I am such a voracious reader, if I'm on a trip, I can have three books with me, you know, and I can finish one. And the execution is fine. It works fine. It's not great or fantastic or fabulous, but it gets the job done when it comes to just purely reading a novel. But I could see that having it in hand, I could see where it could be better. Yeah, it works fine for me, but it could be better.
Well, and here's the question is does it really matter to Amazon? Because Amazon's business model is, you know, I mean, I'm sure they're making money on the Kindle, but the thing is that their real business model is selling the books. So, you know, they have, if they have a Kindle reader, for instance, a Kindle reader application for Apple's new iSlate, do they get into a situation where Amazon is making, you know, making a lot of money anyway? You know, selling it to the both the iSlate and the Kindle.
You're right. You're right. Because, yeah, that's what the benefit of the Kindle is for Amazon. It's for somebody like me. It makes the Kindle my preferred reading device, which means I'm apt to spend more money on Amazon buying my books and only getting it from, you know, the local bookstore, from Book Passage, you know, or from other places if it's not available on the Kindle or if you get it as a gift or whatever. So, yeah, you're right. And it's sort of like a cloud-based model almost.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean because Amazon is they sell books. They sell content. They don't sell – I mean, they sell a lot of other things, but I think that the one of the main reasons for the Kindle to exist was because someone – it was a chicken or egg kind of thing. You can't get people to do electronic download of books until they have a good device to do it on, and so they created that. But the question is, do they really care or need to keep on – I mean, I'm sure they'll keep it making it available. But if Apple became the hardware solution and Amazon was selling into that hardware solution, does it really matter to Amazon?
Do you think they're going to let them? Do you think Apple's going to open it up?
I think they will.
Going to be a standard?
I think they will. I don't think that's going to be the only thing. I think Apple is going to, you know, is going to, and much of, you know, Apple allows Audible. You know, you can buy Audible books directly through iTunes. You know, Apple gets their cut.
You can't buy it at Amazon and play it.
Yeah, you can. There's a Kindle player on the iPhone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, actually, I do. I use my iPhone to buy. You know, this is horrible, but I'll walk into a bookstore and I'll see a title I want. I'll pull out my iPhone, pull up the Kindle app, and I'll buy it. You know, virtually for my Kindle to be downloaded when I get home. Standing in the bookstore.
Oh, you're not the first one to come on the show and confess that. David Rewalt does the same thing.
Yeah, so I mean, I can see, you know, I don't think Amazon really cares if I'm reading it on the Kindle. You know, they're glad that I own the Kindle because my book purchases have gone through the roof since getting it. But if I'm reading the book on an iSlate or some other platform, as long as I'm buying it from them, I think they're happy.
Let's talk about 3D TV. That was, and just really, I mean, we don't have to spend a ton of time on it because probably most folks, that was such the buzz of the show. But I think we need to weigh in on it because you really couldn't, you know, even walk the hallway without hearing somebody buzzing about it and talking about it. And, you know, it's still very early days and a lot of different demos of how it might look like. And, you know, there's some folks who are saying, okay, so I basically have to sit up straight and wear these glasses and be staring at the TV at this particular angle the whole time. Well, Yeah. For now, in some cases, yeah, that is sort of how it works. But it's very early days. Is this going to become the standard, the norm with TV? What do you think are the big challenges that 3D TV faces?
Have you ever lost your remote control? Imagine if you lose your 3D glasses.
Right. Well, exactly that is a stumbling block, isn't it?
Keeping track of four sets of them.
Yeah. I mean, we already have a million remotes to keep track of. I definitely misplaced plenty of them. But, yeah, I mean, the threat of losing a remote doesn't keep us from buying new TVs.
You've got small kids, and they're the ones who would probably enjoy 3D the most, but you're going to lose so many glasses, they're going to get broken. It's like, I think where it's really going to take off 3D TV is in the gaming world, because gamers, I think, are more open to it, and they're more engaged, and they'll pay attention to where their 3D glasses are, and they'll keep them in the same place that they keep their controllers. So I think that's a great opportunity, but the shelf space has to develop, and those TV sets need to get deployed. There has to be a compelling content reason, and, you know, everyone's looking at Avatar going, hey, that's a good reason, but how many avatars are you going to have? I mean, I don't see it happening.
But I do think that we're going to see, and I do think it's a long play. I don't think this is going to happen quickly. But I do see that you're going to have a situation where a lot of the new big movies are going to be done in 3D because you make more money with it. You know, you're able to you charge more. You have, you know, it's a specialty thing. It keeps people going to the theater. So I think that shelf space of movies that are already ready to go into 3D is going to continue to increase. I think that our ability to, you know, acquisition is going to get a lot easier because of that. So you know, getting a camp right now, it's like really, you know, bleeding edge. But, you know, we're going to be able to lock two Scarlets or two Epics or whatever together and shoot, you know, stereo pretty easily in other cameras in the not too distant future. And so the thing is that, you know, being able to acquire this stuff is going to get a lot easier. So there's not going to be a lot of reason not to do it in many ways. And so the thing is, I do think it's going to be coming down the path. I think the people like me, you know, it's going to be one of those things that trickles. It's like the trickle down economy. It is, you know, like I went to see Avatar, and I, you know, the 3D experience was okay. And what I was left with is it would be better if I really could own my own glasses and I didn't have the cheap little, you know, I wear a lot of glasses. And so I'm very nearsighted. So I wear lots of glasses and I'm very sensitive to the quality of the glasses and the glasses that, you know, you get at, you know, a real 3D, you know, theater kind of crap. You know, I'd be happy knowing that more 3D movies are coming out. I'd be happy to go out and spend $100 on real 3D glasses that looked really good and that worked for me and that I was going to get the best experience because I go to enough movies where it makes sense. Now, I think that you may see more and more people, and those people who own those glasses will be more likely to be the ones that buy the first TVs that will be exorbitantly expensive. But that's how plasma came to us. That's how LCDs came to us. That's how all these new technologies come. They come in at $15,000 and only your rich friends have them. And you know, while the shelf life, makes sense. You know, it's the, you know, I think that, but I do think that you'll get a lot of LCDs or whatever that are going to be dual purpose. I mean, you can, most of the time, you're just going to use them as 2D. But then when you want to do 3D, they're capable of it.
It's hard for me to imagine that we're not in 10 to 15 years going to be talking about 3D TV in the same way that we talked about high def just a few years ago before it became, I don't know that it's quite the norm yet, but I think it's pretty darn close to being the norm, to being a standard. It's certainly the standard to which a lot of networks aspire to. But there are a number of networks that are starting to introduce content and announce they'll be producing content in 3D. And I think that there are a lot of very big stumbling blocks that have been talked about here, a lot of challenges on the road to consumer adoption. But ultimately, I don't really think it's that different than the adoption path that many other new iterations of TV have faced in the past. It's got some challenges, but it's hard to imagine that we're not going to be watching TV in 3D or some sort of fully interactive, immersive, you know, different angle experience, you know, down the road. Maybe not in the immediate future, but down the road.
Sure. It's a good point. We don't talk about color television anymore. It's just television.
Exactly. But there's other cool stuff that's happening with the TV is this whole the connected TV. You know, Yahoo made a lot of noise at the show about web widgets, you know, did some new deals. I mean, not all these basically are coming out. There's some new set-top box makers. I'm sorry, some new TV set makers involved now that are allowing these Yahoo widgets on the TV for video on demand, online shopping, social networking, TV shows. Amazon applications, Netflix applications. Morgan, what's your take on this kind of connected TV, widgets on the TV, embedding other programs on the screen itself? I mean, do you think there's a big opportunity for that? Yahoo says that I think by the second quarter we'll have 5 million of these sets. I did a report for Beat TV that came out today interviewing some Yahoo execs about that. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I wish that they'd spend more time focused on connecting these TVs than worrying about 3D, because I think that's really where the opportunity is. One of the most exciting things that I saw, you know, kind of vicariously living through all the CES coverage was the new Boxy box and the idea that, you know, you can have a bookmarklet on your web browser where you're saving shows to watch later on your TV is fantastic. You know, I have the streaming Netflix. And, so I think the convergence of those two devices where, you know, I'm moving back and forth between screens and it really, doesn't matter where I'm at is a huge, you know, I love to see Boxy pushing it further, Netflix, you know, getting big companies on board like Yahoo, you know, you even see Skype and LG teaming up to bring, you know, Skype video conferencing to the large screen. So more and more of that is really exciting.
I think the Skype video conferencing, you know, is going to be huge.
Is that that's like so Jetsons.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. I just saw that. I was like, oh my gosh, it's the Jetsons.
I saw a great joke. The Jetsons didn't have iPhones. I don't know how we're so far off.
Well, maybe iPhones are just a transitionary thing before we end up with TVs that allow you to do all that. And I thought, you know, and these TVs are catching up. I mean, when you look at, there is this kind of interesting conversion convergence where, you know, I was looking at the Apple, you know, 27-inch iMac, and that feels like a TV with a computer built into it. And it looks, you know, the TV manufacturers are moving the other direction.
Yeah.
What do you see? What's the adoption for these type of devices? I mean, do you ever hear consumers talking about them? The Sony Bravias that, you know, bring web connectivity to the TV. I don't know. I mean, I know we kind of live here in our bubble and we talk about things like Roku and Boxy, and those are kind of our over the top plays. But what about on the sets themselves? I mean, I just wonder what consumers actually do want. Do they want these kind of widgets that you access through your remote control? Tim, what do you think?
Two words, Vizio, Walmart.
What's Vizio?
Vizio is a TV manufacturer, and they sell at Walmart, and they sold a lot of Vizios this Christmas. I think they're going to have the connected TV that is at a price point at Walmart that will be competitive to where people will just be buying that TV, and it has the internet connectivity built in. I think that's the one to watch.
And what does that look like? Like, what's on the screen with that? I mean, does it just bring, is it everything internet, or is it?
I think we're going to see some navigation that looks similar to, like, the Roku box, to where you navigate stuff, you know, with an up, down, left, right type button. I also think that there'll be some better mouses that are mice. Would you say, you say mouses, mices? I always forget.
You say mices, I say mouses.
Yeah, some mices. And I think we're going to see some new ways of navigating, whether it's navigating with your thumb. And there's just going to have to be a breakthrough there so that you can navigate in the lean back experience.
Morgan, you were going to say something? Go ahead.
Yeah, did you see the Boxy remote that has the full QWERTY keyboard on the back?
Yeah.
That was a pretty slick.
Yeah, it's yeah, this is pretty cool. Abner, you know, that guy's just, he's thinking all the time. It's amazing.
What's your take on Boxy? I mean, how is Boxy doing? I mean, is the remote the thing that, you know, catapults Boxy to a more mainstream position?
I think it's tough for Boxy. I mean, they threw a great party, don't get me wrong. But I think it's going to be tough for them because things are going to be integrated. So that's really going to be the tough part. You know, I think it's great. I like Boxy, but when somebody else comes out with something similar that's already integrated into the TV and it doesn't use the Boxy technology, that's where it gets tough.
Well, and also,
go ahead, Alex.
I think that when I look at the Roku, I mean, now that they've added all these channels and all this other stuff that you can watch, I have a really hard time adding another box.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know? It seems like if Boxy could license its technology to one of the big cable companies or something like that, that's where I don't think we're going to get a bunch of people buying Boxy boxes.
Yeah. I mean, that's what TiVo tried to do, but they, you know, Comcast went and got their own and DirecTV got their own.
And Boxy is working on that. I mean, one of the things that Boxy has said its goal for 2010 is, you know, we'll be working with the consumer electronics manufacturer. So it'll be interesting to see if next year we're talking about a Vizio TV with Boxy integration sold in Walmart, or, you know, a Toshiba TV or LG or Samsung. But speaking of kind of these new TVs, Toshiba, we were joking about video conferencing, but actually Toshiba is, has an internet connected TV with camera mic for video conferencing. Interesting. Do we want a video conference on our TVs?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I think our parents do.
Yeah, they want to see the grandkids, and it's great that, you know, you could be watching TV and the phone rings and you can decide if you're going to answer it or not on the screen, and or you could just shut it off. And then, you know, there's a lot of traveling businessmen right now that video Skype with their kids. And to be able to do that in a TV environment as well, I think is big.
And there's a lot of integrated things that you get when things are integrated. For instance, you're watching Law & Order or whatever you're watching, Heroes or Fringe or whatever. Someone calls you. You answer the phone on the TV. The TV knows that you're watching that show, automatically starts DVRing it and stops the show. So that you sit there and have the conversation with them, and then you hang up, and it starts playing right from where you were, and you didn't have to think about any of that. You didn't have to figure it out. There was no stress. It just stopped while you were doing it, and starts right back up when you finish. And for your experience is kind of and I think that's the kind of stuff that's available when the system is completely integrated.
And that other driver that drives technology, that one has something to do with dating. I think that. has some valuable benefits as well.
What else, anything else interesting of the show that you guys saw, or Morgan, in your case, that, that you've heard about, that people have been chatting about, buzzing about online, on Twitter, places like that?
I mean, for us, kind of from the filmmaking side of things, Memorex unveiled a new kind of minicam, which kind of pushes that, you know, continues to push the minicam revolution. So it's full touchscreen on the back. It's got, you know, shoots in 1080, you know, very, very nicely done camera. So more entries, more competition there is only a good thing for kind of the avid filmmakers out there. So that was really cool.
Alex, Tim, what else did you guys see or talk about that you liked?
Super high. Well, one of the things that's coming that's, you know, scary is that, you know, you're getting these super high resolution monitors. So, I mean, TVs. So instead of being just HD, as if that was enough, you're now seeing double HD. So LG had one that was 83 inches that just looked crystal clear. Because one of the things, one of the realities is, I know a lot of us have this problem. When we go over 60 inches on our monitor, on our TV, it gets a little pixelated. And, you know, I don't have that problem. But when I was in Japan, I saw a 100-inch screen that was noticeably pixelated when you got close to it. And I was like, you know, eventually they're going to have to increase the resolution. Well, they are. And so now you're getting twice the resolution of HD. All they could show on the show floor was really stills, because they don't really have a lot of video footage that would make that available. But it makes some of these new high-resolution cameras that are on the horizon, high-resolution video cameras and film cameras that are on the horizon, you know, seem more make more sense, you know, because you're going to need that footage just to play back on some of these bigger TVs.
So I shot my own videos at CES, and I didn't use a flip camera. I had a mic. I had my husband's Canon HDV30. You would have been proud of me, Alex. So, you know, I'm not a great photographer. It's not as if I'm doing the cool cutting edge thing and threading two scarlets together and having them mate or anything like that, but you know, I was definitely, I feel like I'm earning some more street cred. I was actually there shooting, and, you know, as Tim saw, my arm was my tripod, but I did it.
That's awesome. It's
shot some videos at CES.
I salute you for doing it on your own, too. It was me plus two. So it was one guy that, you know, one person carrying stuff around, another person shooting. And we shot, I think, for MacBreak, we shot 20, well, MacBreak and TWIP together, we shot about 25 episodes in about 6 hours.
That's amazing.
And we were all pretty beat, you know, by the end. But we were, and those are all coming out this, you know, starting to come out this week. And, I wouldn't even try to do it on my own. And the other thing,
and you know what's interesting is, just somebody who's just kind of starting, I mean, obviously I've been doing video, I've been on the other side, I've been on the camera side, and I've been writing scripts and, you know, figuring out what works in video and understanding the models. And granted, because this was, you know, first time at a show. I mean, I've shot other little things, you know, played around with it at my house or whatever. I actually did an interview with Tim Ferriss last year. And that was, you know, one of the first times I actually shot totally on my own, because, you know, my husband usually shoots with me. But it was sort of getting the pattern down of getting everything plugged into the right space. There's a lot going on. And I know it's partly because, yeah, it was one of my first times doing it, and that kind of becomes rote after a while. But it was, you know, okay, I had the mic, put the mic flag on, turn on the mic button here, then turn it back on the transmitter on top of the camera, and then just making sure that you're listening, that I have my earphones so I can listen to what they're saying, and that it's plugged into the right spot. It was just like the whole dance, if you will, of just putting the whole putting the camera together before you start shooting, was just kind of an interesting workflow to get used to. But it was good. It was pretty cool. I mean, you know, look, this is nothing new. We've talked about this before, how important it is for reporters and really anybody who's in the content creation business to be flexible and to be able to take on multiple roles. And I just think anybody who hasn't tried out shooting for whatever reason should. You know, if you're on some other side of the equation, editing or hosting or whatever, just, you know, make sure you know how to do it all, because in a pinch, it can come in really handy.
I got to walk around with a camera that didn't work and got more attention than I ever, you know, have seen with a camera that did work.
You were walking around.
You were with the Scarlet guy.
Yeah, I was walking around
the
with
my
buddy Ted from Red. And it was hilarious. He's just carrying it in a backpack, and it's a prototype. It wasn't a working camera, but, you know, it showed people how big it was going to be and what it looked like. And it was just hilarious to watch him milk it. He would, you know, they'd go, well, what about the Scarlet? He goes, got it right here. And they would just stop what they were doing. And the funniest was at the end of the conference, we were walking through the parking lot. We see the Engadget trailer, and Ted's like, you know, I wonder if Engadget would like to look at this. And so we walk in the trailer door, and there's like 30 guys and two girls sitting at laptops on these tables. And we walk in, and they look at us like, oh, no, not another group of people trying to sell us their crappy product or get us to cover their crappy product. They just this look of disgust on their face. And Ted goes, hi, I'm Ted from Red Camera. And they're like, the Red Camera? And he's like, yeah. And I just want to stop in and say hi. Oh, hey, when are we going to see the Scarlet? He goes, well, I got it right here. Everybody jumps out of their chair and they run over to his backpack. They're whipping out their cameras. They're all shooting like the 7Ds from Canon. And he slowly pulls it out. He just milked it. And then he has it wrapped up in like this little sack, and he unwraps it, and they're shooting everything. It was a scream to watch it all happen. And they were just salivating over this camera that doesn't work.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, I just want to say that's the whole thing we were talking about. The same thing with Apple is that you know that it's going to take a while for Red to come out with the stuff, but you know, I mean, it was all it was all vaporware when they talked about the Red One, and they were like, oh yeah, Red One, it's never going to come out. But it came out, and it has changed everything, you know. And so people know that Red can back this stuff up. Did he give any more dates?
Spring, summer-ish is when the Scarlet, I mean, Epic's coming out as well, probably around the same time.
Yeah.
So there were a few other cool things that I saw on the floor walking around, and some of them had nothing to do with media at all. There was a company that made recycled polymer structural blocks that were made out of water bottles. And I thought about you, Alex, and all the African stuff that you're doing. I thought this was really cool. Yeah. You know, you send water to people if there's a disaster, and then they can use the leftover water bottles to make a structure to live in if there's a disaster. I thought that was really...
Now, was it easy to push it back into that? Or what does it take to manufacture those blocks?
In terms of manufacturing, I don't know what they do, but they're you know, they're plastic water bottles that are actually these blocks that connect.
Right.
And you can go to my Twitter stream and take a look. I took a picture of it there.
Yeah.
Another cool thing that I saw was a solar powered iPhone charger.
Yeah, I saw that. That was cool.
For $69.99, that was pretty cool. It's called Surge. Mm-hmm. And then I saw the Panasonic twin lens 3D camera for $21,000, and it's made to order. That just looked silly fun, you know, to have a 3D camera. I don't know if I want to pay $21,000 for it.
But we can rent it.
Yeah, you can rent it. And the craziest, the most ludicrous thing that I saw was, I don't know exactly how much this keyboard weighed, but it looked like it weighed around 3 pounds, and you could slide your iPhone into
the
it.
iType.
The iType. I don't know. Doesn't look like something for me.
We covered that. We covered it on MacBreak. It was one of those things. We went over there because I was really excited about the opportunity to have a keyboard, but it wasn't quite what I expected. IO, by the way, who makes that, though, makes a lot of cool interfaces. They have a great interface for iTunes to turn your iTunes into basically like a DJ, you know, booth.
Yeah, I saw that, too, and I was like, oh, you know, seems like a great idea. And then you're like, oh, I'm carrying around a netbook now.
Exactly. But you're not. You're still interfacing with your...
Right.
Yeah. Anything else?
That seemed to be, you know, I mean, the boxy box we already talked about. And then, you know, seeing some of the solar-powered film strips that were there that, you know, eventually these companies want to have your entire roof made out of these solar strips, which I thought was pretty cool.
Awesome. Anything else for you, Morgan?
I saw Blue, the microphone manufacturer, had a very cool iPhone attachment for...
Oh, really?
Yeah, external mic. Very, very well, you know, classic Blue design, like really well done, and perfect for podcasting or interviews when you need...
Is that one out? Is it out?
I don't know if it was out. I saw it, though, and I was like, want...
Yeah.
Yeah, because I have had so much trouble using. I got a little mic out of Hong Kong that fits on the iPhone, and it swivels so that you can point it at the person you're interviewing. And I was so excited about it. Steve Garfield from stevegarfield.com told me about it, and I checked it out, and it worked great the first two times. But after keeping it in my pocket, I did an interview with Ileana Douglas, and it just came out bad. And then I did one with the folks from the Grammys who have a really cool social media thing that they were showing off, and I can't use it. I mean, the audio is just horrible.
And I have to admit, I mean, this blew. You're talking about the Mikey? Is it the Mikey that you're talking about, Morgan?
I can't remember the name, maybe.
But the you know, the thing that I'm excited, I mean, it's great to have a microphone on it. I have to admit that what I really want is an XLR input.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't need you to think. I don't need people to think about it anymore. Just give me a little connector that pops onto the bottom and gives me an XLR connection to my iPhone, so that I can. And then I wouldn't. 90% of the time, that's what I'd be using for interviews, because it would just be with me all the time. It'd be one little component rather than taking around an H4N, which is typically I'm carrying it around all the time is like an H4N, and then when we do real interviews, we record on, you know, sound devices and stuff like that. So, but it does look cool for $79. It's a pretty slick little deal. Hey Morgan, where can people find you?
So they can find me on Twitter at Morgan B, and also Turn Here is on Twitter at Turn Here or turnhere.com, and I blog at pmorganbrown.com as well, mostly about marketing, video, stuff like that. So.
Excellent. And Tim, where can people find you?
OneTimStreet.com.
Fantastic. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.